This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, July 21st, 2008. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. Zimbabwe's rival political factions agree to start talks aimed at ending that country's crisis. In Pakistan, Taliban militants are forcing women to leave schools. And we take a look at India's new climate action plan. Will it actually put a dent in pollution from one of the world's fastest growing economies? Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Hamdan, pleaded not guilty to supporting terrorism, marking the beginning of detainee trials at Guantanamo Bay. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
Hamdan has been held since 2002. The government claims he received military training in an al-Qaeda camp and that he smuggled weapons for the organization. Hamdan's lawyers say he was tortured by U.S. officials. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled that the Bush administration's initial plan to try detainees was unconstitutional, saying detainees have a right to representation. Many questions remain regarding how the U.S. should try alleged enemy combatants. Just today, Attorney General Michael Mukasey said Congress needs to define the rules for civilian trials at Guantanamo Bay. But that didn't stop Hamdan's trial from proceeding. At least five U.S. military officials will decide the case. If he is found guilty, he could face a life sentence. Only 20 detainees held at Guantanamo Bay have been charged with crimes, though 260 people are held there. Only 60 to 80 of those held are expected to have trials. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A report by British government MPs calls for a thorough review of U.S. interrogation techniques. The Foreign Affairs Select Committee also said that the U.K. has a legal and moral obligation to ensure that no rendition flights land on British territory. Citing differing definitions of the word torture, the MPs said that Britain should not accept assurances from the U.S. that they do not employ torture. The committee used as an example the practice of waterboarding, which they clearly call torture, but which the U.S. defines as a legal technique and which President Bush has refused to ban. The report concluded that assurances were unreliable from an administration that purports to uphold the civil and political standards of behavior while in fact kidnapping people and taking them to places where they may be maltreated. The report could affect extradition from the U.K. to the United States. At a weekend mass in Australia, Pope Benedict XVI said he was deeply sorry for sexual abuse committed by clergy. Critics say the apology was too little, too late. They called on the Pope to commit church resources to provide support for victims and demanded that the pontiff instruct bishops in Australia to stop blocking access to the courts. They also said the apology should have been made directly to victims. Today, the Pope met with four such victims of sexual abuse by clergy. A U.S. appeals court today overturned the FCC's decision to fine CBS $550,000 for airing a momentary image of Janet Jackson's breast during the 2004 Super Bowl broadcast. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit said the FCC, quote, arbitrarily and capriciously departed from its prior policy that exempted fleeting violations. There was no immediate comment by the FCC. In Nepal, the Constituent Assembly elected its first president today after officially ending 240 years of monarchy last May. P.C. Dubey reports.
The new president is Ram Baran Yadav, a physician turned politician who belongs to the Nepali Congress. Yadav defeated the Maoist candidate with 52% of the vote. His victory reflects an alliance between the Nepali Congress, the mainstream Communist Party, and the Madhesi Janadhikar Party. In return of their support, the Nepali Congress has pledged to vote for the mainstream Communist candidate for chairman of the Constituent Assembly. The Madhesi Party's candidate has already been elected vice president of the country. Above all, the new president is expected to bridge the gap between the Madhesis and Paharis in the country. But political observers fear that the defeat of the Maoist candidate could imperil the ongoing peace process and the Maoists could resort to terror tactics again. For FSRN, I am P.C. Dubey in Birganj, Nepal.
The future is up in the air today for India's coalition government and its historic nuclear deal with the United States. If the Congress party and its allies lose a no-confidence vote scheduled for tomorrow, the government will collapse, opening the door for the BJP to return to power. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Prime Minister Manmohan Singh moved the motion of confidence in his Council of Ministers in the House beginning a two-day debate on the issue. The tally on the major is so close that the government temporarily released six MPs from jail who were serving sentences for crimes including murder and bribery. The opposition brought in two members who were in the hospital recovering from surgery. Left allies withdrew their support earlier this month, protesting the contentious India-US nuclear deal. They say the deal will give the United States too much influence over India's foreign policy. Prime Minister Singh brokered the deal with President Bush and touts it as the answer to India's chronic energy shortage. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Zimbabwe's rival political factions have signed an agreement to start talks on resolving the country's political crisis. ZANU-PF's Robert Mugabe, along with both Arthur Mutambora and Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change, committed to talks whose goal is to reach a resolution within 2 weeks. Davison Makanga has more.
The three leaders agreed to put the plight of citizens before political power. The usually belligerent Mugabe called for cooperation from his rivals. The 84-year-old said he's fully committed to the dialogue process.
We must act, if we haven't done so before, now, as Zimbabweans. Think as Zimbabweans and act as Zimbabweans. Do it ourselves. Be masters of our own destiny.
The Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC's Morgan Tsvangirai, echoed Mugabe's sentiments, saying the Southern African nation should work together for the good of its people. Tsvangirai said the government should immediately halt its hate campaign against perceived opposition activists. The MDC leader delayed signing of the agreement, citing irregularities in the original framework.
We put our heads together. I am sure we can find a solution. In fact, not finding a solution is not an option.
South African President Thabo Mbeki said he is optimistic that the process will pull through. Mbeki, who was appointed by the intergovernmental bloc Southern Africa Development Community, he has been criticized for his soft approach towards the Zimbabwean crisis.
That it commits the negotiating parties to an intense program of work to try and finalize the negotiations as quickly as possible.
Meanwhile, political analysts have warned negotiating parties to brace themselves for stiff differences during the dialogue process. Raymond Majongwa of the Zimbabwe Solidarity Forum said the parties should emulate the South African model that led to the end of apartheid in 1994.
Zimbabwe is not in a unique situation. This has happened in many countries where people have been at war and ultimately they go to negotiate. And as I panel it, the real model of democracy that we're talking about. The South African democratic dispensation that the world celebrates now is a result of serious acrimony, violence, and engagement and ultimate victory for the people of South Africa was achieved through negotiation at a negotiating table.
Meanwhile, Zimbabwe, as well as the rest of the world, is waiting to see what progress will come from today's deal as talks commence. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Davison Makanga in Cape Town.
In Pakistan's Swat Valley, a Taliban commander has issued a fatwa that women's education is un-Islamic. His forces have bombed over a dozen girls' schools in the past month. Now the Taliban wants to transform the buildings into religious seminaries. More than 2,000 girls have already quit school in Pakistan because of Taliban threats. FSRN correspondent Rahmanullah has more.
The singing students say because of their efforts, darkness will say goodbye to the world and their sparkling will enlighten every corner of the globe. But now the Taliban have become the writers of the destinies in the Lali Swat Valley. They have darkened the world of over 2,000 girl students who have been forced to abandon their education. The Taliban made most of the area's 525 schools dysfunctional and bombed over a dozen in June. According to Muslim Khan, spokesman for local Taliban, they bombed the schools because the army used them as bunkers. But for their commander, Maulana Fazlullah, women's education is un-Islamic. He says girls' schools are a source of obscenity and vulgarity in the valley.
of harsh orientation.
We can never tolerate such girls' schools where our women may become prostitutes. The people have seen that these schools have produced no good results. Quran teaches that women should get education in purdah and should be confined to the four walls of their houses. We and our friends have seminaries that impart both science and religious education to the girls.
The Taliban choose to either bomb or torch girls' schools in Swat. A local professor, Iltaf Hussain, was abducted last month. He was teaching in a co-education private school. Ziauddin Yusufzai is an educationist and a secretary of the private school's management in Swat. He says government rate has ceased in Swat and the district administration has failed to safeguard future of girls here.
Targeting of girls' schools is a matter of great concern. In other parts of the world, children are getting proper education. Here, a hatched conspiracy works to push us into that ignorant era where people were burying their daughters alive. Girls' education has been badly affected in Swat, and 30% of the girls' students have quit learning in schools.
Waqif Khan is police chief in Swat. He confesses police are helpless to confront militancy and need a grand army operation.
The Taliban have control in most part of Swat. They have torched girls' schools in their control area where our posts are empty. The Taliban have even captured our police stations that we retook with great difficulty. This is a war and police are not supposed to deal with it. The duty of police is to deal with the routine crimes. We need an army support. 110 of my policemen have lost limbs, arms, and eyes, and 38 have been killed in the last 6 to 7 months.
Rubina Khan was an 8th class student. She wants to become a doctor, but her dreams were shattered when Taliban torched her school.
I always stood first in the class. I want to become a doctor and serve my countrymen. The Taliban asked us to wear burqas. We started wearing burqas, but they still barred us from school and torched our school. The government did nothing for us. Many of my friends have also given up on getting an education.
A local journalist in Swat, Sherin Zada, says parents are worried about the future of their daughters. For the sake of their daughters' education, parents are ready to send them to school in Pardah.
Swat has an Islamic culture. Here are a number of seminaries where girls are imparted Islamic teachings. A trend towards religious education has increased more after the Taliban commander edict. The bombing of girls' schools will badly affect the literacy rate in Swat.
Pakistan government launched army operations against the Taliban in Swat in October 2007. The Northwest Frontier Province government inked a peace agreement with Taliban in May this year. In the agreement, Taliban had agreed to refrain from damaging government buildings. But 1 month later, they burnt over a dozen schools. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rahmanullah in Peshawar, Pakistan.
An immigrant's beating death in a small town in Pennsylvania is igniting debates over race and immigration. Luis Ramirez had been in Shenandoah for 6 years. He had steady work, 2 children, and a fiancé whom he planned to marry and bring back to Mexico with him. The Saturday before last, friends dropped him off at a park. Then they got a call saying he'd gotten into a fight. When they returned, he was being beaten by a group of youth. After one kicked him in the head, they say he started convulsing and foaming at the mouth. He died in a hospital the following Monday. The group that beat Ramirez reportedly included several members of Shenandoah's popular high school football team. Several witnesses to the beating say the group of youth shouted ethnic slurs. One witness, an ex-police officer, said they shouted to Ramirez's friends that they should leave Shenandoah or, quote, "you're going to be laying here next to him." But so far, both police and local officials say they don't think the beating was racially motivated. And though investigations continue, over 1 week after the beating, there have been no arrests. Joining me to discuss the issue is Margaret Barajas. She is CEO of Palo, the Pennsylvania Association of Latino Organizations. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
Margaret, start by telling me a little bit about Shenandoah, the town where this took place.
Shenandoah is not unlike many smaller towns here in Pennsylvania. You still have neighborhoods where you know your neighbors, and the quality of schools is better than you can find in larger cities. And these are small towns that pride themselves on being close-knit.
There were multiple witnesses to this beating, and as you said, it's a small town. Do you think it's unusual there haven't been any arrests yet?
I think it's very unusual, in particular because Pennsylvania prides itself on having a strong response to what is considered a hate crime, and by all indications, this fits the criteria for that.
Both elected city officials and police officials have said they do not think the attack was racially motivated. Your response?
Well, my response on behalf of the Latino community here in Pennsylvania is, unfortunately, we're often not surprised when officials do not respond quickly. But it is nevertheless disturbing for us.
You mentioned Hazleton, which is near Shenandoah. And the mayor there, Lou Barletta, made national headlines a couple years ago when he started pushing a measure to penalize landlords for renting to undocumented immigrants. That made him quite popular. He's running for Congress right now. Do you think measures like that inflame tensions or just reflect the tensions that already exist in that area?
Well, what's certain is that they don't help an individual to feel included or wanted in a community. But really, it's nothing more than fear-mongering. There's no other way to describe it. When a member of a family feels that they're threatened in some way, the easiest way to make them feel better is to give them a perceived sense of security. And really, that's what these local initiatives have been about, is really just fear-mongering.
In this area, in central Pennsylvania, a lot of the white families there are grandchildren of immigrants. Why do you think it's so different when it comes to Latinos?
Well, across the nation, the population of Latinos is increasing. They mentioned that that Luis Ramirez was there and was, I believe, had two or three jobs. He was a part of the community. But as individuals begin to perceive that they may not be doing as well as they'd like, either financially or socially, it's human nature to want to hunker down and become afraid of someone that you don't know. But what's important to remember here is that while we can talk about human nature or being concerned about your own particular culture, an individual was killed here and was killed for no other reason than he was walking down the street while being Latino. And that's really the issue we need to look at, is what is our response as a society when people behave in this way, and how do we hold them accountable?
Well, Margaret Barajas, I want to thank you very much for joining us here on Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much.
Margaret Barajas is Chief Executive Officer of PALO, the Pennsylvania Association of Latino Organizations. Last Thursday, the American Civil Liberties Union released documents showing that undercover officers from the Maryland State Police infiltrated and spied on peace and anti-death penalty groups in 2005, continuing the surveillance for over a year, despite finding no criminal activity. Some of the activists were placed on a watch list under the category terrorism, anti-war activist. Leanne Caldwell takes a look at how police infiltration has expanded in the years since September 11th.
Max Abuzuski has been an activist for nearly 30 years. He started protesting the National Security Agency, the agency most known today for the domestic wiretapping program, in 1996.
I will be doing this as long as I'm physically possible.
According to the Maryland State Police's use of a federal database, Abuzuski's first crime is terrorism, anti-war protester. His secondary crime, terrorism, anti-government activity.
I'm in a drug trafficking database labeled as a terrorist. We had suspicions, so it was unsurprising to find out that there's surveillance, that they're infiltrating our meetings, our rallies, etc. But I couldn't believe they would do something like that. I was shocked.
46 pages of police documents released after a lawsuit reveal that in 2005 and 2006, Maryland State Police officers infiltrated the activist group Pledge of Resistance Baltimore and the anti-death penalty groups Campaign to End the Death Penalty and Committee to Save Vernon Evans. Over 14 months, analyst Sparwasser, as he or she is identified, attended meetings, protests, and took detailed notes, including the names of other organizations, including the Catholic Church, the NAACP, and Amnesty International. The American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland believes this information is being shared with 134 local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. ACLU attorney David Rocha.
What happened is so clearly wrong and so clearly chilling of legitimate First Amendment rights that a full accounting is, I think, absolutely critical. And the public deserves to know how this started, how it was allowed to go on, what the full scope was, and what kind of binding legal controls are going to be put in place to ensure that it never happens again. That's what we've asked for, and should that not be forthcoming, we will pursue every avenue that we have at our disposal to ensure that those questions and those questions are answered and those things happen.
The Maryland Police Department denies any illegal activity. Spokesperson Greg Shipley.
I mean, I can't get any more specific than we've said in that. We continue to be subject to the lawsuit that's ongoing, and it's just, I can't discuss it further.
Since September 11th, the mission and resources of law enforcement officials has changed. The actions that fall under terrorism activity have broadened. Millions of dollars have been given to both federal and local homeland security projects, and law enforcement has been directed to not only police terrorist activity, but attempt to prevent such activity. One result, an increased watch of activists. Through lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act requests, activists around the country believe they have been spied on by local and federal law enforcement agencies. For example, in Colorado in 2004, the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force compiled detailed information on one activist with the group Food Not Bombs, a group that works to focus policy from war to social programs. Also in Colorado, the FBI questioned activists about their plans for that year's Republican National Convention, where tens of thousands of activists were expected and did protest. Similar FBI activity was found in six other states. In a separate terrorist watch operation, nearly 200 anti-war activists' names were on a database run by the Pentagon. The list, called Talon, was created by then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Its purpose was to document unproven suspicious activity or the possibility of terrorism. Mike German with the American Civil Liberties Union says the array of watch lists and terrorism-focused activity is expansive and unknown.
You know, rather than admitting that it's science fiction, they're pretending that it's true, and it's actually, you know, not just sucking up a lot of security resources that could be better spent, but actually having an impact on innocent people's rights.
Along with the ACLU, the Maryland police activists are working to obtain more information on the monitoring activity. The current governor, Democrat Martin O'Malley, says he hopes the monitoring is still not going on. He says he's looking into it. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And now, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The outsiders rode within. It should surprise no one that the candidacy of Illinois Senator Barack Obama has evoked fascination, not least because of his presumed outsider status as a man of at least partial African descent. It is this racial inheritance that accounts to a considerable degree for the fascination among both blacks and whites posed by his candidacy. But as ever, in America, race often hides as much as it reveals. For if Barack is an outsider to the American body politic because of his blackness, he is too an outsider to much of black America, precisely because of his direct East African heritage, one unleavened and unmitigated by the 500 years of black bondage, resistance, repression, and rebellion that is at the heart of the African American experience and identity. In this sense, Obama is a double outsider, and as such, he has had to work out his own way into what being black in America means. His somewhat unique outsider status reminds us of the uniqueness of another great outsider who became the consummate insider, Napoleon Bonaparte. Consider this. Imagine a man born on the Italian-speaking island of Corsica in 1769. By the time he was 30, he was named First Consul, or Dictator of France. In 5 years, he was Emperor of a vast French Empire. My point isn't to malign Obama as a dictator-in-waiting. It's to show an example of how an outsider becomes the ultimate insider. When Napoleon was a boy in military school in France, his fellow students ridiculed him and made fun of him, not because of height, as might be expected, but because of his Corsican accent. Napoleon eventually became more French than the French. And today, by virtue of his brilliance, his French nationalism, and military exploits, he's regarded as one of the greatest Frenchmen who've ever lived. Obama, as a boy in Indonesia, was made fun of because of his kinky hair and perhaps his slightly darker brown complexion. What does that mean in his formation of a sense of self? We don't know, but Freud reminds us that the child is father to the man. When Obama speaks, especially in his post-primary incarnation, one hears a profound nationalism. He has spoken in the past of an American history that many of us know has never really existed. It has forced him to denounce a man he once knew, admired, and respected. Here I speak, of course, of the Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright, for making whites uncomfortable by speaking ugly truths about American history at home and abroad. Is this but the necessary shifts occasioned by the nasty game of politics? Or is this the road occasioned by outsider, making that transition to the consummate insider? Time will tell. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Catherine Kopp and Vinod K. Joes produced today's broadcast. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Puck Lowe. For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, go to our website, www.fsrn.org. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert, sitting in for Auto Bogato.